You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to The History of China. Episode 268, The War of the Three Feudatories. The 16 Maxims. 1. Highly esteem filial piety and brotherly submission to give due weight to social relations. 2. Behave generously toward your family to promote harmony and peace. 3. Cultivate peace within the neighborhood to prevent quarrels and lawsuits. 4. Respect farming and the cultivation of mulberry trees to ensure sufficient clothing and food. 5. Be moderate and economical in order to avoid wasting away your livelihood. 6. Give weight to schools and academies in order to honor the scholar. 7. Wipe out strange beliefs to elevate the correct doctrine. 8. Elucidate the laws in order to warn the ignorant and obstinate. 9. Show propriety and tactful courtesy to elevate customs and manners. 10. Work diligently in your chosen callings to quiet your ambitions. 11. Instruct sons and younger brothers to keep them from doing wrong. 12. Hold back false accusations to safeguard the good and honest. 13. Warn against sheltering deserters lest you share their punishment. 14. Promptly and fully pay your taxes lest you need to be pressed to pay them. 15. Join together in hundreds and tithings to end theft and robbery. 16. Free yourself from enmity and anger to show respect to your body and life. The Sacred Edict of the Kangxi Emperor, published circa 1670. Throughout its vast history, Chinese official historiography has reserved some of its highest accolades for rulers who functioned as a unifier by drawing the country together after a protracted period of civil war. Because the fall of Ming, at least in retrospect, appeared to have been so swift and the concurrent rise of the Qing so assured, it can sometimes be forgotten that it was a distinct and terrifying possibility that there may have been a protracted breakup of China at the time of this particular transition. Much of the credit for preventing that outcome, therefore, must actually go to our emperor today, just as it was last time, the Kangxi Emperor, who, in the words of Jonathan D. Spence, would therefore be justified in receiving, quote, if not the aura of a Qin Shi Huangdi or a Sui Wendi, at least that of a Han Gaozu or Song Taizu, end quote. The steps toward reunification in the Kangxi reign included suppressing the last Ming claimants, breaking the Three Feudatories or San Fan revolt, conquering Taiwan, and integrating Han Chinese into networks of official service to the state. This is what we're going to focus on today. Now, before getting too laudatory of the Kangxi Emperor and his period of reign, it must be said that, while chronologically within the Kangxi reign, the final suppression of the last Ming claimants must be seen as a triumph of the Oboi Regency, which itself followed policies initially formulated by Dorgon in the Shunzhi period. No man is an island, after all. By 1661, the Qing armies had eliminated all the major Ming claimants except for Zhu Yulong, the Prince of Gui, who was a grandson of the Wanli Emperor. Even Zhu Yulong, though, had been forced out of Yunnan and all the way to Burma, where the Burmese king Bin Tale kept him under virtual house arrest in Sangang, across the Irrawaddy River from the town of Ava. Two of Zhu's generals, Li Dingguo and Bo Wanxuan, kept sizable armies and occupied much of northeastern Burma. But they could not break through to Sangang to liberate their ruler. In August 1661, King Bin Tale was killed in a palace coup, and his successor imprisoned Zhu. When Wu Songhui approached Ava in 1662 with a large force, the new Burmese king handed over Zhu Yulong and Zhu's son, Zhu Zexuan, to Wu Songhui. And thus, without further ado, Wu had the two executed by strangulation. General Li Dingguo died a few weeks later after hearing the news of Zhu Yulong's death. Thus it was with the death of this last claimant to the Ming throne, who possessed both title and an army, the last gasp went out of the main Ming loyalist resistance. Shortly before his death, however, Zhu Yulong had enfeoffed the loyalist commander, Zheng Chenggong, with the new title Prince of Chao, which was in addition to the honorific title of Prince of Yanping, conferred on Zheng in 1655. Zheng, or as we better know him, Ko Xinga, continued to support the Ming cause and resistance to Qing. He and a sizable army landed on Taiwan in April 1661, just after the Kangxi Emperor's accession, and after a long and hard siege, seized Fort Zeelandia from the Dutch early in 1662. Though Ko Xinga died that same summer, his son, Zheng Jing, continued to hold Taiwan after being forced to abandon his base in Fujian. Zheng held out in Taiwan despite Dutch attempts to link up with the Qing forces in a counterattack, and despite the draconian policies issued by the Oboi Regency on the advice of General Huang Wu, of removing the inhabitants from southeastern coastal areas 10 to 20 miles inland in an attempt to deny all supplies and recruits for the Zheng regime, as we discussed last time. At approximately the same time that Zhu Yulong enfeoffed Zheng Chenggong, the Qing government, at the urgings of Hong Chengzhou, the former Ming governor general of Liao Dong, who is now a grand secretary, granted Wu Songwei both civil and military authority over the province of Yunnan. After the execution of Zhu Yulong, Wu's jurisdiction was extended to Guizhou. In the next decade, Wu consolidated his power over the administration, tax structure, and appointment processes in both provinces, and also took monopoly control over salt and copper mining, ginseng distribution, and trade with Tibet. He built costly palaces and maintained a powerful army, despite steady Qing attempts to reduce the troops under his command. By 1670, when his influence had spread to include much of Hunan, Sichuan, Gansu, and even Shanxi, he was costing the central government an estimated 20 million taels a year, much of which had to be siphoned off from the revenues of the Jiangnan region. Two other powerful military figures whose families had defected to the Qing also developed similar powers, although to a lesser scale. They were Shang Keshi in Guangdong and Geng Jingzong in Fujian. They ruled these territories as their own domains, and their strong personal power, backed by wealth and trained troops, meant that the Qing court had virtually no control over the provinces in the south and southwest. By 1672, the young Kangxi emperor and a small group of advisors, working within the broader framework of the Council of Princes and High Officials, determined that the main threat to continued survival of the Qing regime came not from Chinese values, as Oboi had seemed to have feared, but rather from the independent military powers of the three feudatories. Since the feudatories had numerous friends in Beijing and within the Council of Princes and High Officials, Songgetu was one of the leaders of the peace party seeking to avoid any conflict, for instance. Coherent planning for any campaign was extremely difficult, and security leaks were frequent. An opportunity presented itself in the summer of 1673 when Shang Keshi submitted a memorial requesting permission to retire. The emperor passed the matter on to the Council of Princes for discussion. Their recommendation was that the transfer request be accepted, though Grand Secretary Tuhai and perhaps some others disagreed strongly. The Kangxi Emperor would later write, quote, "Since I had already made up my mind, I therefore ordered his transfer," end quote. In August, a transfer request also arrived from Wu Songwei, which radically altered the picture. This time, according to the Kangxi Emperor's later reminiscences, only 5 men in the whole council went along with the young emperor's decision to grant Wu Songwei's request. With only this minority backing, the Kangxi emperor decided to challenge Wu and ignore the majority's vague warnings of disaster. As the emperor rather apologetically reflected on his decision 8 harsh years later, quote, "These others did not explicitly say that transferring Wu Songwei would certainly lead to rebellion," end quote. Interestingly, though, the editors of the veritable records dropped the word explicitly, or Ming, thus erasing from the formal historical record the admission of ambivalence or even misjudgment that Kangxi had privately been willing to make about himself. The court's acceptance of Wu Songwei's request, which was designed to test the court's intentions, made Wu determined to revolt. The news of Wu's rebellion reached Beijing in January 1674, and the same day there was an uprising in the city, led by a pretender to the Ming throne, a self-styled Zhu Sanzi, who managed to rally several hundred household slaves from the plain yellow and border yellow banners before troops cut them down as they fought through the streets. This local rising, occurring as it did in the context of the larger rebellion, almost certainly led to random reprisals against Han Chinese in Beijing by Qing troops. Edicts were issued urging those who had fled the city in a panic to return, and the city gates were thereafter kept closed to prevent any further exodus. While coping with this local crisis, the emperor was swamped with news of defeats from Qing troops, suicides of loyal officials, and the defection of Wu Sangui, as well as the majority of the southwestern bureaucracy. The emperor's response was to send a vanguard at top speed to hold Jingzhou, some 200 miles up the Yangtze River from Wuhan, with orders to press down into Hunan from that base. The garrison troops in Xi'an were ordered to move to Sichuan. Sun Yanling was ordered to hold Guangxi, and messengers were sent to recall the transfer orders sent to the two other feudatories, that of Shang Keshi and Geng Jingzhong. At the end of January 1674, the emperor had established two main staging areas for all troops and supplies that were to be used in the war. One, at Yanzhou, in Shandong near the Grand Canal, was to handle all logistics for Jiangnan and Jiangxi, and, by implication, for Fujian and Guangdong if the other feudatories should revolt. The other at Taiyuan, the key river and road junction in Shanxi, was to control the flow to Shanxi, Sichuan, and the southwest. Prince Lergian was named commander-in-chief of the pacification armies. The appointment of Lergian is worth brief consideration, not least because he proved to be an extremely inept general who severely hampered the war effort. We can only guess as the reasons for his selection, but one important reason was undoubtedly that he was his father's son. Throughout his reign, the Kangxi Emperor showed a deep faith that the sons of capable and loyal men would prove as loyal and capable as their fathers had been. Though the results of this policy were often unfortunate, he never seemed to have wavered from it, but continued to appoint sons to the same kinds of jobs in the same areas where their fathers had served. Lergian was the son of Lekedehun, Lekedehun bearing the title of General Who Pacified the South, or Pingnan Da Jiangjun, had pacified the Ming armies in Zhejiang in 1645, in Hubei in 1646, and in Hunan and Guangxi in 1649. Furthermore, the family were direct descendants of Nurhaci, and Lergian was famous for his physical strength as well as being the head of the imperial clan court. Lekedehun had been called the Pingnan General, and accordingly, Lergian was named Ningnan, or the Southern Pacifying General, a synonymous echo of his father's former greatness. In the fighting of early 1674, the Qing forces did astonishingly poorly. The armies of Wu Sangui moved swiftly northward. They captured most areas south of the Yangtze, and in the west, pushed up through Sichuan toward Gansu and Shanxi. Hundreds of senior Qing officials in southern provinces defected to the rebel side, and the situation was rendered even more dangerous by crises elsewhere. In Gansu, General Wang Fujian, a former Wu Sangui subordinate thought to be completely loyal to the Qing, defected after, he claimed, being insulted by Molo, his nominal superior officer, and took much of Gansu and Shanxi into the rebel camp. In Guangxi, General Sun Yanling, a member of the Council of Princes and High Officials, and ennobled as the consort of an imperial princess, killed his fellow Qing officers and threw his lot in with Wu Sangui. Geng Jingzhong followed suit with his huge Fujian feudatory region. These two defections lost the Qing virtually all South China, except for Guangdong, where Shang Keshi remained loyal to the Qing, even though his son was known to be dangerous and unpredictable. Swallowing his pride, the Kangxi Emperor offered Wu Sangui and Wu's entire family an amnesty in the summer of 1674, just before fighting began at Yuezhou. For his part, Wu rejected the offer. In the spring of 1675, the Mongol leader Bernie revolted in Manchuria and led an army on Mukden, where his father had earlier been imprisoned on the orders of the Kangxi Emperor. A major war on the northern front, possibly linked to Mongol risings further west, became an added threat to a Qing court that was running dangerously low on troops. The army that was finally assembled for the Mukden campaigns under General Oja and Tuhai also being president of the Ministry of Revenue at the time, was a motley one, to say the least, made up primarily of untrained bannermen and even some of their household slaves, reinforced, as such things go, with the guards of northern Mansolia. In spite of all this, though, they managed to rout Bernie, and he was later killed by the Korchin Mongols. During the Oboi Regency, the young Kangxi Emperor was almost certainly helped to power by his grandmother, as we talked about previously. This lady, the widow of Hong Taiji, was herself a Korchin Mongol of the Borjigit clan. Now as Grand Empress Dowager, Taihuang Taiho, She also played a major part in breaking Bernie. The politics of this brief war are intriguing and serve as a useful reminder, in the middle of the larger civil war in the south, that the Kangxi Emperor himself had important Mongol ties. Early in 1675, Sinju, a guard officer with the entourage of Bernie's stepmother, learned that Bernie was planning a coup. Though this guard officer could not absent himself without arousing suspicion, he was able to send his own younger brother to Beijing in order to warn the Kangxi Emperor. The Emperor was now at the same sort of quandary that he'd been with the three feudatories. If he took direct action, he might precipitate the very crisis he was trying to avoid. So he had his grandmother send one of her trusted bodyguards, named Serang, to invite various Mongol princes and leaders to Beijing. Suspecting a trap, Bernie arrested Serang and tried to rally the Tumut Mongols to his cause, but the Tumuts informed the Kangxi Emperor. At about the same time, Sinju arrived in Beijing with his full report. In addition to sending off the army under Oja and Tuhai, the Kangxi Emperor offered Bernie full amnesty and a princedom if he would return to his allegiance. This dual policy of marshaling force and offering amnesty at the same time was a common tactic of the Kangxi Emperor. But on this occasion, he carried it in a new direction by preparing for a much more serious crisis. A director named Mala from the Court of Colonial Affairs, the Manchu and Mongol staff department which handled the policies in the northern and western regions, was appointed as coordinator of troops who were to be drawn from a wide range of tribes, such as the Korchin, the Aru Korchin, Onegit, Barin, Karachin, Tumut, and Jarud. Thus, we see that the concept of a federation of Mongol troops was used by the Qing court, just as such a federation could be used against it. It's within this specific context that we should evaluate the brief item in the variable records, in which it is stated that at just this time the Kangxi Emperor ordered his diarist to cease accompanying him when he visited the Empress Dowager and Grand Empress Dowager. They were just routine visits in accordance with filial piety, said the Emperor, and there was no need for anyone else to come along. But if we're right in asserting the key political role that the Kangxi Emperor's grandmother played, then we can infer that he would wish to have certain conversations with her in absolute privacy. Despite his victory over Bernie, the war in the south continued to go badly for the Kangxi Emperor, and it's at this juncture, around the spring and early summer of 1675, that the balance of documents in the veritable records and the thrust of the Emperor's edicts began to shift in an important way. Sarcasm and even anger with Manchu generals became increasingly common, as does warm praise for certain Hanjun banner generals. Part of this was to boost Chinese morale and to prevent any more mutinies like that of Wang Fushun. But it also seems clear that the Kangxi Emperor had grown disillusioned with the performance of his Manchu commanders. In July, the Emperor ordered the execution of a Manchu general for desertion in the face of the enemy. At the same time, he began to lavish praise on Han Chinese generals like Wang Jianbo, Sun Shuke, Zhang Yong, and Chen Fu. This evidence, plus the fact that at the war's end the Kangxi Emperor had large numbers of senior Manchu generals investigated and degraded for incompetence, strongly suggests that the Manchu banner forces were in disarray as early as this time, a full century before the Qianlong reign, which is generally given as the date that the decline began to be obvious. Undoubtedly, the nadir for Qing forces came in early 1676. The third feudatory, Shang Zixin, who had long been fence-sitting, now rebelled in Guangdong, and one of the emperor's most vaunted generals, Chen Fu, was killed in a mutiny in Ningxia. The campaigns were bogged down in Zhejiang, Shanxi, and Hunan. The Qing dynasty would not be in such serious military trouble again until the Taiping rebels' triumphs in 1853. And even then, the Qing court kept control over more areas than they had in 1676. The Kangxi Emperor would later tell his children that this was the only period of his entire reign that he could not prevent his despair from showing on his face. Morale had grown so low that posters openly criticizing the emperor were displayed near Beijing. Then, with startling suddenness, the course of the war turned. The government forces were shown, after all, to have greater resources. The dissident generals and the feudatories began to wary of the protracted conflict and to fight amongst themselves. Though Wu Songhui had minted his own currency and developed a moderately systematic tax collection scheme, the rebels as a whole never developed a coherent administration that would recruit promising new leaders and apportion revenue efficiently. For such reasons, and perhaps also because Wu Songhui was demanding and arrogant, the rebel forces began to fragment. Wang Fushun returned to the Qing allegiance in July 1677, shaving his head and regrowing his queue in sign of submission. The Kangxi Emperor promptly renamed him a general in the Qing army and used his troops in western China. That November, the feudatory Geng Jingzhong surrendered to General Giesu in Fujian, and his troops were sent to Jiangxi so that an attack from the east could be launched into Hunan. The feudatory Shang Jishin surrendered in January 1677, and later that year, Wu Songgui had Sun Yanling murdered in Guilin because it was believed that he too was about to surrender. Thus, the only major threats remaining to the Qing forces were Wu Songgui himself in the southwest, and Zheng Jing, son of the Ming loyalist Zheng Chengong, aka Koxinga, who still threatened the southeast coast from his base in Taiwan. In April 1677, a now confident Kangxi emperor announced that since the war was going so well, he would have time once again to take up his work in poetry and calligraphy in earnest. The last 4 years of the war saw a steady series of Qing victories, first against Wu Songgui, and then, after Wu's death from apparently natural causes in 1678, against Wu's grandson, Wu Shifan, who finally committed suicide in Yunnan in December of 1681. This effectively ended the war, since Zheng Jing had been defeated near Amoy in 1680 and forced to withdraw to Taiwan, dying there in 1681. In early 1682, the Council of Princes and High Officials and the Ministry of War recommended that large numbers of rebel generals be executed and the families enslaved. Though there was no general bloodbath, it cannot be said that the Kangxi Emperor was immensely lenient. He approved death sentences on many, and death by a thousand cuts or slow slicing for Geng Jingzhong and several others. Unknown hundreds were also beheaded or hacked to death in front of the victorious troops. Some of those killed were men who had surrendered in good faith, believing that they would.
In all human history, there are few stories like that of ancient Egypt. On the banks of the Nile, these people created one of the most enduring and significant cultures. Their tale comes to life in the History of Egypt podcast. Every week, we explore the tales of this amazing culture, from the legendary days of creation and the gods, all the way to Cleopatra, and everything in between. The History of Egypt podcast is written and produced by a trained Egyptologist. We go much deeper than your average documentary or magazine article to uncover tales of life, great endeavors, and the amazing arc of a mighty kingdom. The History of Egypt podcast is available on all podcasting platforms, apps, and websites. Come, visit ancient Egypt and experience a legendary culture.
Received amnesty from the Kangxi Emperor, as he had repeatedly promised. An edict, which the Emperor sent to General Giesu in 1680, proves that the Emperor had no intention of keeping his word in all cases. Quote, "I think that whenever you are going to do something, you must think through both the background and the consequences. If it will be to the benefit of the state, then you can take action. But lightly embarking on a dangerous course will inevitably lead to trouble. At the present time, the remaining rebel groups who are stretching out their necks in their desire to return to the right path cannot just be numbered by hundreds or thousands. If we now kill Geng Jingzhong, then not only will those who have already surrendered expect to receive the same punishment at a later date, but those who have not yet surrendered will note this example and grow cold at heart, with unknown consequences. If you are really able to do what I have ordered and get him to come to Beijing, then everything will be settled peacefully." End quote. 2 years later, having traveled to Beijing in good faith, Geng was then executed by slow slicing and his head displayed in public. As a peaceful settlement, such a policy was both ruthless and successful. The Kangxi Emperor had learned a great deal in the course of this war. He acknowledged that the war, engaged in its protracted bitterness, brought immense hardship to the civilian population of South China and expressed his regret in numerous edicts. The one inescapable triumph, however, was that the empire was now reunited and the Qing leader secure on the throne once again. Yet even to the end of the Qing dynasty, neither the Kangxi Emperor nor any other Qing emperor ever traveled farther south than Hangzhou, and none ever visited the southwest or Sichuan. After the suppression of the three feudatories, the tenacity of the Zheng family rebel regime off the coast of Fujian continued to be troublesome. They maintained a hold over several offshore islands, as well as their fortified base on Taiwan. Their presence there, and the strength of their fleet in conjunction with the coastal population prohibitions hampered trade along the whole Fujian coast, as well as parts of Zhejiang and Guangdong. Despite the factional struggles within the family and Zheng Jing's own unpredictability, there was little chance of moving against him while the Three Feudatories War continued. But as soon as that was over, the Kangxi Emperor sought a possible leader for an amphibious operation against Taiwan and, following the advice of Li Guangdi, chose Shilong. Shi had served as an admiral of the Zheng family's fleets during the early 1640s. When he defected to the Qing, Zhen Chenggong had killed Shi's father, brother, and son. Thus, Shi's personal history was intricately and tragically combined with his knowledge of the coast and of naval warfare. An additional advantage was the intimate work he had established with merchants and officials in the major trading ports. Shilong insisted on having an independent command, not one shared with a veteran governor-general of Fujian named Yao Qisheng, who might have used the campaign to strengthen his own commercial contacts. Shi was also dependent of Wu Xingzuo, the powerful bondservant serving as governor-general of Guangxi and Guangdong, who'd gained his office, according to contemporary rumors, by offering to the court 10,000 taels more for the post than Yao was willing to pay. Wu had profited hugely from confiscating the fortunes of the southern merchants who had thrown in their lot with the now-defeated feudatory Shang Jiexin, and was building up his own commercial and administrative power base. Backed by the Kangxi Emperor, Shi assembled a fleet of 300 vessels and defeated the Zheng family's leading naval commander, Liu Guoxuan, in a major engagement near the Pescadores. A few weeks later, in October 1683, the last members of the Zheng family in Taiwan surrendered. Following the campaign, Taiwan was divided into three counties and established as a prefecture of Fujian province. Slowly, over the next 50 years, despite a nominal ban on immigration and settlement, the island became an attractive area for Chinese trade and agricultural development. The western shore plains of the island were steadily transformed to rice and sugar production, though the Kangxi Emperor and his officials showed considerable resolve in helping to maintain the economic livelihood and contracted rights of the aboriginal inhabitants. This reunification, or at least reestablishment of central control, was accompanied by specific cultural policies designed to integrate the members of the Chinese literate elite into the Qing state. The vigorous policies of the Oboi Regency, directed against major delinquent taxpayers and against the alleged cultural accommodations of the Xunzhi regime, were now deliberately reversed by the Kangxi Emperor. The emperor himself gained skill with Chinese language by different means. During the Oboi Regency, he learned surreptitiously from his personal eunuchs such as Zhang Xingcheng. During the Three Feudatories War, he studied with a small nucleus of trusted Chinese-speaking Manchu tutors like the erudite Lasari and Fudari. He read extensively with accomplished Chinese senior tutors and diarists in the Hanlin Academy, such as Xiong Zili and Sun Saifeng, and studied formally with several erudite scholars who became his personal favorites, like Gao Shiqi and Zhang Ying. Thanks to such training, despite the interruptions caused by the war, by the late 1670s, he was making interpretive comments on Chinese classical texts with some conviction to his own educated subjects. Though it remains an important aspect of his reign that it was a largely bilingual one, and with many of the emperor's most important confidants, spoke and wrote fluently in Manchu. The emperor had to exercise both tact and caution with respect to cultural unity and integration. The refusal to serve the Qing on the grounds that such refusal was mandated by the idea of continuing loyalty to the Ming dynasty was still present in the 1670s and 80s, even though some of those taking loyalist stances had been children at the time the Ming fell in 1644. The Bo Shui Hengzhu examination of 1679 opened to scholars recommended for having outstanding ability and summoned by imperial order, was a calculated act of cultural public relations on the part of the Kangxi Emperor. The special examination was designed to integrate those of wavering or unproven loyalty into the regime itself. The key inducement offered was an opportunity for successful candidates to work on the compilation of the official history of the Ming. Though 36 out of the 188 invited, including such famous names as Tu Yue and Fu Shan, managed to evade the honor or use the opportunity to meet in private with like-minded scholars who resented or even hated the Manchus, and some eminent scholars like Gu Yanwu and Huang Zongxi were able to ensure that they were not asked to participate, all of the 50 who were successful at the examination became officials for the new dynasty. The Bo Shui Hengzhu examination was directed at those in the Yangtze Delta region, which was the center of scholarly endeavors and where much of the initial resistance to the Qing conquest had been concentrated. Almost half of the 50 successful candidates, 23 exactly, were from Jiangsu, and an additional 13 were from Zhejiang. The Bolshoi-Hangzhou examinations, it should be said, did not solve all of the problems either with the loyalists or with the analytical difficulties of Ming historiography. Neither Wang Fuzhi nor Gu Yanwu would have anything to do formally with the project. Neither would Huang Zongshi, though he consented to having his own works copied and made available to the compilers and to letting his youngest son work on the project. Also, two of Huang's most brilliant pupils, Wan Xuzeng and Wan Yan, worked on the Ming project for many years. Wang Xutong, in particular, found an outlet for his scholarly skills in the Beijing home of the Ming history director Xu Yuanwen. Despite the talents of these and other compilers, and despite the Kangxi Emperor's flow of edicts concerning the urgency of the search for accurate data, including such devices as intensive interviews with former officials and eunuchs who had lived through the Ming dynasty's fading years, the project was hindered by incompetence, by numerous resignations among the staff, by delays and factional squabbles involving powerful administrators such as Xu Yuanwen and his brothers, and by the deceitful editorial practices of senior court officials like Wang Hongxu. On a darker level, problems endured for decades. The discovery and swift execution in 1708 of the last Ming direct imperial descendant, Zhu Zihuan, who, though living peacefully as a scholar and teacher, was invoked by some rebels in Zhejiang as, quote-unquote, the third crown prince Zhu, or Zhu Santaizi, highlighted the state's jumpiness over the issue of the vanquished Ming imperial house. In 1713, execution of the talented and well-connected scholar Dai Mingshi, on charges of misusing oral history data and treasonously employing Ming reign titles after the Qing dynasty was already established, showed that historiography remained politically sensitive. In general, after the special Bolshoi examination of 1679, the examination system functioned successfully as an integrative mechanism, and the emperor worked hard to make it so. In the years immediately following the suppression of the three feudatories, there were repeated efforts to modify the arbitrary North and South Jinshi quotas, which continued to discriminate against qualified candidates in the northwestern and southwestern provinces. In 1685, an attempt was made to have three main zones. In 1691, the Kangxi Emperor tried a more complex system that would place candidates into six separate zones. Those from Jiangnan and Zhejiang would be in the so-called south-left division, Jiangxi, Huguang, Fujian, and Guangdong in the south-right, Zili and Shandong in the north-left, Henan, Shanxi, and Shanxi in the north-right, Sichuan and Yunnan in the center-left, and Guangxi and Guizhou in the center-right. When even this breakdown proved fruitless in getting successful candidates from every province, the emperor decided in 1712 to abolish the broader groupings and to go for a precise quota system based on province or affiliation with Manchu, Mongol, or Hanjun banners. The exact numbers would vary in proportion to qualified Juren available. Some years before, in 1705, the emperor had already begun an informal system of applying the principle of geographical quotas to admission into the prestigious Hanlin Academy, which had up until this time seemed the pinnacle of scholarly attainment. Now, men from poor or border areas such as Gansu, Yunnan, Shanxi, or Guizhou could join a scattering of bannermen among those from Jiangsu or Zhejiang. As if to reinforce these provisions even further, the emperor took the unusual step in 1716 of ordering the Grand Secretariat to consider the proposition that all officials from border provinces who were retiring from office should return to their ancestral homes, taking their culture and money with them, and not to settle in some more culturally advantaged place. So successful had the balanced pattern of Hanlin admissions become that when it was abandoned, apparently by oversight, during the first years of the Yongzhen reign, there was a prompt protest from scholars. The idea of geographical, as well as an ethnic and civil military unification, had become an accepted part of maintaining the status quo. And that is where we're going to leave off today. Next time, we will be getting into the middle years of the Kangxi reign. Hope you'll join us then. But until then, as always, thanks for listening.
The French Revolution set Europe ablaze. It was an age of enlightenment and progress, but also of tyranny and oppression. It was an age of glory and an age of tragedy. One man stood above it all. This was the age of Napoleon. I'm Everett Rummage, host of the Age of Napoleon podcast. Join me as I examine the life and times of one of the most fascinating and enigmatic characters in modern history. Look for the Age of Napoleon wherever you find your podcasts.